I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Ways and Means Committee. I'm sorry, that gavel. It's a new gavel today. It works well. I was testing it. We do have a quorum. Representative Igo, would you have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Igo moves approval of our minutes. Is there discussion to the motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, and the minutes are approved. Members, we have two presentations today regarding the intersection between what's happening in Washington, D.C., and our state budget picture. Obviously, this is something that changes sometimes by the hour, the chaos and confusion in Washington, but we wanted to make sure members had the most up-to-date information. So we will have both a presentation from NCSL, followed by a presentation from MMB. We're going to start with the NCSL presentation since our presenter is joining us via Zoom, Brian Wonko from NCSL. Mr. Wonko, are you there?
I am. Good morning. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. You can proceed,
sir. All right. Well, thank you. Good morning. Thank you to Co-Chair Stevenson and Co-Chair Torkelson for convening this hearing. Thank you to all the members for the opportunity to present today. NCSL always appreciates legislative engagement. It is in our blood, and I'm happy to be here today. NCSL represents legislators to advance the effectiveness, independence, and integrity of legislators, including representative states in Washington, D.C., on policy derived by state legislators in our committee process and approved at our annual summit. I'm the Senior Legislative Director for Budgets and Revenue, and I work in NCSL's D.C. office on the State Federal Affairs team. Today, I will start with a quick overview of where we are in the federal budget process, followed by a small summarization of appropriations and reconciliation activity. I'll touch on funding freezes and then note some scenarios for states in your consideration. First, I'd just like to highlight the ongoing collision of initiatives here in D.C. You said chaos and confusion, and lately there seems to be a lot of it. But we are here to help, and we are, you know, covering and reading and looking into things, pounding the pavement on Capitol Hill. So, again, I'm happy to be here. We have the federal budget reconciliation process, funding freezes by executive orders, tax reform, and debt limit all happening at the same time, with varying states of negotiation among Senate and House, R&D, Congress, and the White House, all creating uncertainty for states. These all have quick impacts. Fiscal year 2026, federal funding to states, meaning this October 1st. For the freeze, the initial days of the new administration with the release of executive orders saw a quick adjusting by all levels of government, federal, state, and local, and many implementing partners across the nation. Furthermore, at the release of a White House Office of Management budget memo in January, brought misunderstandings on how to implement that memo. We also saw problems with payments to states and what we were told were unrelated shutdown of various payment portals. This combined caused confusion and uncertainty that led to the withdrawing of the memo. So the memo was actually rescinded just a few days later. In addition, more uncertainty exists due to several lawsuits, including several being led by consortiums of state attorney generals. Meanwhile, the White House still is pushing forward its policies contained in the OMB memo, even with its rescission, even with it being rescinded and with the court cases. And I'll discuss a little bit more on the memo in a minute. Again, these collision of policies in the executive and Congress is unprecedented, and there have been many integral policy components all being integrated simultaneously, where in the past they might have been dealt separately in separate pieces of legislation and separate presidential initiatives. I'd like to focus on appropriations and reconciliation, which means tough decisions by members of Congress. The top lines are set with the House passing the House budget bill over the year, and this is the preferred route by the administration. Authorizing committees and appropriations subcommittee chairs will now face even tougher spending choices within their jurisdictions. And I know I'm late in sharing a slide with Sean, but I do have one I can share just with the top line numbers, and I think it'll help just ease the conversation. So give me a second, and I can share that right now.
And this slide is in members' packets.
Oh, great. Thank you. So the House reconciliation numbers, again, this is what was included in the legislation that did pass the House. And this is where we're looking at, you know, major cuts. And then, you know, really to pay for that last line for ways and means where it says plus 4.5 trillion. So that's going to be the extension of Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as well as additional, you know, tax considerations. So we kind of have to get, you know, do the math and figure out how we are going to get there. So again, we look at reconciliation gives top line targets to committees. So this is the House budget sending instructions back to you, the authorizing committees, to cut funding. Such cuts are limited to budgetary impacts. So it can't be like new policy or, you know, changing old policies, you know, the authorization aspects. It's really just the fiscal numbers. Because the Byrd rule blocks provisions of reconciliations bills that are extraneous to reconciliation's basic purpose of implementing those budget changes. So again, looking at the math, you know, some of the big numbers that we see there, you know, the $880 billion is going to be, you know, looking at green energy programs. And this is also where Medicaid is going to be. Over $2 trillion for Medicaid is on the table to get, you know, to the number for the cuts. We recognize Medicaid as a bulk of state concern, and NCSL is actively working to bring additional data on specific impacts of state changes regarding Medicaid in the next month here. So stay tuned. We'll certainly share that widely as we aggregate the information and, you know, see what other states are doing specifically to that. We also just did a couple webinars on Medicaid just 2 weeks ago. It can be found on our website as well, you know, looking at different states as, you know, examples of what they're doing specifically to Medicaid. I do applaud the actors in your state. A quick Google search this morning brought up an article on a working groups looking at the issue within your state. And so we see that in many other states as well. For the ag number, the $230 billion that we have, these are going to be programs on the table, such as Thrifty Flu Plan. We have other nutrition plans, such as TANF and SNAP. We see also for ag programs, executive orders already terminating ag-related energy programs and the curtailing of ag assistance, such as local food sourcing for schools. Another number there is education, the workforce of $330 billion. Of course, we saw changes just last week with the executive order to move the education department. If nothing else, this has administrative budgetary reverberations with, you know, the reconciliation appropriations and how, you know, we look at this moving forward. Things will be moved around just administratively, and the processes for states will be impacted. We're already seeing headlines of saying the Small Business Administration will take over student loans and Health and Human Services will take over nutrition and other assistance programs. So it's just the mere fact of changing how we do business and, you know, how states then interface with, you know, their respective programs. The vast majority of Department of Education funding is through non-mandatory appropriations. Fiscal year 24, the Department of Education used $79.1 billion in non-mandatory funding. A lot of times it's non-mandatory funding, you know, especially where there is flexibilities around it, are targets for the most cuts. Reconciliation is likely impact student loan programs, which is completely funded by mandatory spending. For example, you know, one is to change the Biden era plan of the SAVE plan of IDR payments, and that could be upwards of $127 billion in savings. So a lot of things, you know, can be considered to get to some of these numbers. For education in particular, especially then if we go to, you know, K through 12, any impacts to states might be really indirect. We see where other budget cuts might, you know, have adverse reverberations within, you know, the education sector, you know, kind of robbing Peter to pay whole of Paul and feed some of the funding holes. Again, ways and means where I put the 4.5 trillion. Again, this is where you're going to find the extension of the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Some of the things of discussion there are certainly child tax credit. We have consideration of earned income tax credit. We have consideration of changes or keeping a robust standard deduction. Again, all these might possibly have impacts at the state level, especially where you have corresponding programs that augment between federal and state. One other thing of note is I know it impacts state and local government that's kind of on the chopping block is bonds. So you have state and local tax exempt bonds, and that's another area that is part of the discussion that could be removing the tax exempt status for those bonds. So that you would create more cost as far as being more competitive in the bond market for state and localities. So you will certainly have that a consideration for how to sell bonds. That's it for the slide, and give me 1 second. I will exit out. One other thing just to note where I did mention the debt ceiling. So in the conversations that we have around the federal budget, debt ceiling is still there and kind of lurking in the shadows. Certainly it's on the mind for your more fiscally minded members of Congress. That would certainly play in. This debt ceiling was suspended in the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2023, but that expired at the end of 2024. Such a tactic may be repeated, but again, fiscal hawks and coalitions of those fiscal-minded members might remember that the deficit still increased considerably with the Fiscal Responsibility Act, so might not want to go down that path again, even if it is preferred by the president. Another thing just to mention is time. This is all happening, very quickly. We look at the Tax Cuts and Job Act. It alone wasn't acted until December 2017. This was 11 months after Trump took office, and it was a standalone focus. So you didn't have this collision of so many other things taking place. I just want to show, add that as an example. Just, there is time considerations. They're certainly moving, there's a lot of balls in play with equal priority, and there's certainly a lot of opportunity for derailment because there's so much going on. States may want to plan contingencies for, different approvals, when we see legislation actually go later into the year. Next, a bit on the executive orders and the funding freezes. I did kind of mention it in the opening. So there was a memo that was released in January that highlighted, seven specific areas that rescinded prior presidential initiatives. Two of these of note have some of the most impact on funding, unleashing American energy, and then ending radical and wasteful government DEI programs and profiting. So those were the titles of executive orders that were included, specifically named out in the OMB memo. These are the White House terms for DEI policy, and unleashing American energy, really repealed what they termed as Biden era Green New Deal. A supporting memo, a second memo that had instructions going out to agencies and offices, highlighted 50 plus pages of programs in an Excel sheet that sought quick review. And a lot of this is where the initial funding freezes came, and some of them were quick to be unfrozen within 48 to 72 hours. However, some others, are permanently frozen or actually had their contracts or any procurement mechanism, terminated. The third memo was released, just a couple more days later, that was rescinded the original memo. Again, I just want to remind folks that, presidential, priorities remain, even if a memo is rescinded. And we see, not only the court cases, but, the removal of the memo have, not slowed things down to that regard. We continue to urge dialogue between the White House and states to allow time for compliance and, understanding. And we did have, immediate dialogue with the White House to that regard. I also share with capital offices whenever I go up, which is, you know, several a week, that, you know, states, their timeframes are different from the federal government. So the impacts that they're considering will impact FY26, where a lot of states already have enacted their budgets then and would have to go back in to make those changes. Politics aside, legislative fiscal officers have concerns about planning capabilities. You know, it's hard to construct and pass budgets without knowing, you know, what the federal flows to states or the impacts on revenue from federal tax changes will have on state revenue collection. You know, of course, this is not all the same for each state. Some states are more coupled to federal policy than others. Again, we also, you know, just the court cases, you know, will take time. And, you know, so again, that, you know, will delay things past, you know, the normal state budget, you know, process timelines. Lastly, as for issues with states, you know, learning how certain provisions of, you know, federal tax cuts will impact their states. I think states are questions they're asking themselves is, you know, how will changes to, you know, the standard deduction impact state revenue? Again, especially where, you know, policy or, you know, they're linked, you know, state and is linked to federal tax rates. How will other tax credits impact states where federal policy is coupled with state policy, you know, such as earned income tax credit or child tax credit? You know, a lot of these policies are meant to augment one each other to have bang for your buck. So if we see, you know, less, you know, federal benefit, you know, how does that impact, you know, state benefit and, you know, the cuts and, you know, the population that they're supposed to serve? Again, Medicaid, I mean, it is certainly the elephant in the room for when we have conversations. Will budgetary holes brought by Medicaid cuts have impacts elsewhere in state funding? You know, does tightening the belt to fill holes, you know, impact, again, education or other state social services? Lastly, in talking with one state finance chair, you know, they're looking at one single digit cut across the entire budget. So they're just looking at you know, taking a proactive approach, and, you know, cutting 5 to 6%, knowing that, you know, they'll have these type of, I would say, unprecedented, you know, impacts on their state. Other states are taking a more reactive approach. You know, they're trying to, you know, find specifically, you know, where programs, you know, such as, you know, earned income tax credit impact other programs, and where cuts or increases or decreases, you know, to rates, you know, to the credit rates might impact, you know, their state, and then reacting accordingly. So I'll leave that. I know there's a lot to always discuss in D.C. I tried to make it brief and kind of go fast, so I apologize. You know, I could probably talk for an entire hour and probably don't want me to, but happy to take any questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wonka. We do have some members with questions. I'm going to take the chair's prerogative, though, and ask a question first. And it's a timing question. Our legislative session ends, you know, May 19th. We have to have an enacted and balanced budget by the end of June 30. Obviously, some of these proposed cuts could have significant impact on our position here in Minnesota, most notably these proposed Medicaid cuts. Can you speak at all about the timing of when we could expect federal action on these proposals?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned earlier that things change, you know, by the hour, and we get constantly, you know, changing time frames. So I would say you can't really name a date. I would more just caution, you know, to plan accordingly that, you know, these things will go past May. You have the possibility of, you know, next couple of weeks, they don't have any language for the bills yet. Everything's still in the committee process. So this is the end of March, going well into April, and then, you know, well past into May. And that's kind of highlighting, again, you had TCJ in 2017, presidential priority that went entire 11 months. So the timeframes they're speaking of are very, I would say, optimistic. Again, the House bill was one big, beautiful bill. Senate took two different tracks or was planning on two different tracks. with one being more focused on energy and border, then leaving some of the tax issues for a second bill. If the first bill, the House bill, kind of, you know, hits roadblocks and kind of stumbles, you might see then carving it out. So again, there's no crystal ball. I would, you know, unfortunately, you know, states and I guess people, you know, organizations across the country kind of just faced with, you know, planning for multiple scenarios. So
yeah, it does speak to the challenges we face when we have the possibility of a multi-billion dollar hole being blown in our budget really at any moment, but probably more likely after the end of our legislative session, maybe even after the end of our fiscal year. It does create considerable challenges. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wanko, for this this presentation. So a few things. Well, Mr. Wanko and I have met before, I co-chair the tax committee, and we talk about incidents a lot in taxes. It's like a way for us to think about where the benefits and burdens of different fiscal policies kind of what income level they accrue to. And within that, we also talk about the relative regressivity or progressivity of different policy proposals. And so it was with great interest that I saw a couple days ago this report out of the Budget Lab at Yale. It's like this nonpartisan policy analysis shop. Because these numbers, of course, when we see the budget resolution, there isn't a lot of detail, and so it's kind of have to make assumptions about it to figure out the different interacting parts of it. But basically, I mean, this was a report on the distributional impacts of what we can kind of put together about this budget resolution. And the top line of it is that this budget resolution represents a massive redistribution of wealth in our country from the bottom to the top. So, you know, their analysis showed that on net, this proposal, this Republican budget will raise costs for the bottom 40% of Americans and greatly enrich the top 1% and especially the top 0.1%. You talked about a few tax policies that we think might be in this tax package. And the three that were mentioned were the increase in the standard deduction, the child tax credit, and the earned income tax credit. And these are convenient ones, frankly, to talk about in the context of a Republican tax bill, because they're the ones that actually like help working class people out. The earned income tax credit is sort of our biggest refundable tax credit focused toward low income people. As we all know, the national child tax credit, when it was in place during COVID, cut child poverty in a half. The increase in the standard deduction, which is a federal change that we conformed with in 2017. The TCJA raised it. It's a big deal for lower income people. We conformed permanently with it. What it did for us, for our tax code, is that it means that now 96% of people take the standard deduction rather than itemizing, which, you know, opens up some possibilities for us to look at some of those itemized deductions and the cost and who they're going to and whether that's like the most prudent use of our money. But the child tax credit, the standard deduction, and the earned income tax credit are most certainly not the only parts of this Republican tax bill. Mostly the spending in this Republican, can assume about this Republican tax bill based on previous behavior and what people have said publicly that they're going to do, is massive tax cuts for the wealthy, massive tax cuts for the biggest corporations. The one of the few assumptions that we were able to include about federal action in the February forecast was we know the feds are going to further cut the corporate franchise tax rate. We can assume that. And so, you know, it's interesting to me because you'll hear a lot from, you know, the Trump-Musk administration and from Republicans about the national debt, about our trade deficits, But when you look at this budget, they're not proposing to cut medical care for little kids and elders and people with disabilities and food support for children and working families and seniors who are facing food insecurity so that they can balance the national debt. Oh, no, no, no. They want to cut medical and food and food for children and seniors and low-income people so that they can give $4 trillion in tax cuts to the top 1%, the top 0.1%, and the biggest corporations who are making out like bandits. And so, you know, people can say what they want, but these are numbers, and these tell a real damning story about the priorities of this administration and about whose backs we're going to give our friends tax cuts on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. And I don't think you had a question. That was great comments.
Just
observation. Yeah. Well, and you, but you did touch on something that I wanted to ask Mr. Wanko about, which is that when I look at this slide, you know, we have to have obviously a balanced budget in Minnesota. There's no such requirement in the federal government. And, you know, the slide indicates $4.5 trillion in tax cuts balanced against some amount of spending reductions. But I don't think, as you just observed, that the spending reductions equate to the amount of the tax cuts. Mr. Wanko, is that accurate, that the federal government's contemplating cutting taxes by a much larger amount than they're contemplating reducing spending?
Yeah. And again, I throw in the caveat of how they actually, you know, it's kind of a partisan divide of how they're accounting for the budget and looking at the numbers. So kind of depending on which party you ask, you know frankly, they have different answers. So in short, what's being reported is, you know, this reconciliation process will actually add $2 trillion to deficit over the course of the 10 years.
Yeah, so adding $2 trillion in deficit to fund those tax cuts that Chair Gomez was just discussing. Representative Pinto.
Thanks, Chair. That was actually the question I was going to ask, is just adding up the other numbers add up to $1.2 trillion in reductions and then $4.5 trillion increase for those for the tax cut for the wealthy. That's all. Thanks.
All right. I'm not seeing any other member questions, so we will thank you, Mr. Wanko, and we will move to the next part of our agenda today, which is a presentation from MMB on the federal interactions with the state budgets. We have state budget. We have with us today Anna Mingi, the state budget director, and Dave Greenman, the chief financial officer for DHS, who are making their way up to the front. And as soon as you are settled, you may begin with your presentation. There is a slide deck and members packet.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anna Mingi. I'm State Budget Director and Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Today, I'm here with my colleague, Dave Greenman, from the Department of Human Services to give you all an update on federal funds and their relation to the state budget, as well as some work that our agency has been doing to monitor an evolving situation with the federal government. I wanted to start out by giving you all a sense of the magnitude of federal funds that the state and state agencies specifically are managing at any given time. In particular, this fiscal year 2025, which, as you all know, we are moving through quickly. But in 2025, the state agencies are managing almost 700 distinct federal grants, some larger than others, as you'll see on a later slide, that total over $23 billion. And when we put that in context on the next slide of our total budget, now we look, this is a biennial look, federal funds make up over one-third of our state budget. So we project that in 2024 and 2025, in total, the state will bring in about $121 billion. And of that, 35% is money coming from the federal government. So as you can see, that's a, you know, it's a pretty significant piece of our pie here. So looking, pivoting back to just 2025 alone, you know, I mentioned there's about $23 billion. Of that, $13.1 billion is supporting state entitlement programs. So those are programs that state statute guarantees to individuals as long as they meet certain eligibility criteria like their age or their income limit. So that means it's about 56% of the federal awards that we are receiving. What this also means is that if there are changes to these specific programs at the federal level, because these Minnesotans are guaranteed this benefit, it means our budget would fill in the gap to the extent federal support for these programs falls. Unsurprisingly, most of these entitlements are in the health and human services space and in our education space. As you just heard, and as my colleague will discuss more later, there are changes being considered at the federal level, including changes to Medicaid, which could reduce funding to the state by over $1 billion per year. So this slide, I wanted to dig in and give you a sense of sort of where is that federal funding coming? What programs is it supporting? And unsurprisingly, to a budget person like me, Medicaid is receiving more than half of the total. And this is both support for our state medical assistance program, largely, and then also some administrative support for both the Department of Human Services and some of our local partners, such as county governments, and then also tribal partners as well. There is also significant funding to our transportation agency, over $3 billion at MnDOT. SNAP, which provides food support, is budgeted for $1.6 billion this year. And then other programs like Minnesota Care, the Child Care Development Block Grant, and a whole host of others. So to give you a sense of magnitude, I made this chart and pulled everything that was more than like $180 million a year. But recognizing there are 700 unique line items, there's a lot of smaller things in that all other $3 billion square. But sort of focusing in on some of our larger programs. First, our healthcare programs, namely medical assistance and Minnesota Care. So medical assistance provides healthcare to roughly 1.2 Minnesotans on average every month this year, say fiscal year 2025. The federal government covers a percentage of the state's claims, and it varies a bit by program. For most groups, it's about 51%, except for in adults without children, also known as the Medicaid expansion population, and there the federal government covers 90%. And this is the distinction between the 51% and the 90% is significant as it relates to conversations going on about the federal budget. The percentage is set by a formula in federal law, and it changes because it's sort of a relationship between how state per capita incomes are changing relative to federal, sort of national per capita incomes. Minnesota for a long time was at the floor of 50%. Now we've gone up slightly, but still relatively low compared to some other states. Federal funding in MA is growing. By 2029, we project it'll be almost $15 billion. And that's because, as I mentioned earlier, the feds just pay a percentage of what we spend. It's not a capped grant program where all the growth accrues to the state. We are sort of growing in parallel. And then, as I noted, there is also significant administrative funding that's flowing to the entities who are administering Medicaid across the state. Minnesota Care is another federally supported healthcare program. It serves slightly higher income individuals, adults between 138% and 200% of poverty. And they also pay, some pay small premiums. The state here receives about 95% of the tax credits that an individual would receive if they went to MnSure to purchase their own health care. And here we cover roughly 100,000 Minnesotans. And this is a place where the state in this fiscal year is budgeting to receive just under $600 million. I'm going backwards, I'm sorry. There's also significant funding supporting our program serving children and families across the state. I mentioned SNAP, which is an abbreviation for the Supplemental Nutrition Program. This program provides food assistance for almost 500,000 low-income families with children, seniors, and adults with disabilities, with an average benefit of about $6 a day or about $108 a month. The Child Care Development Block Grant, we are projecting about $550 million this year. It will fall next year as we sort of finish spending some temporary ARPA CCDBG dollars, but this one program it supports is our Child Care Assistance Program, serving 13,000 families per month, but also additional support for programs serving child care providers and workers. And then lastly, on this slide is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Block Grant, or TANF, which supports the Minnesota Family Investment Program, which provides employment counseling and financial assistance to families in poverty. This serves about 24,000 families a month, and about 70% of the individuals served are children. Pivoting now to education, three main funding streams I'd highlight. First, special education, where we are expecting about $230 million this year. This is primarily reimbursing our school districts for some of the cost of providing special ed services. I'd note the federal share here is much smaller than the state contribution, and I know the conversation of the special ed cross subsidy is something that that the legislature has had a lot of discussions about in recent years. Also, school nutrition programs receive about $430 million this year. The bulk of this, about three-fourths, is for school breakfast and lunch. And then there are other programs that support or provide food in settings and times outside of the normal school calendar. And the final education funding stream I'll highlight is Title I, which provides funding for low-income schools to assist education of students at risk of not meeting standards. You saw on the previous, or on the chart, some significant funding for transportation. We have about $3 billion in federal funds budgeted this fiscal year, providing funding for things like aeronautics, state and local roads and bridges, and some funding for transit. I'd note this slide doesn't include the Met Council, but this is just MnDOT money. So, as you heard from the previous presenter, there's been a lot going on in our work with the federal government since January. In particular, in late January, a memo from the Federal Office of Management and Budget that sort of directed a pause on funds pause on the disbursement of federal funding, as well as call-outs for pauses in some specific areas in executive orders. And while the OMB memo was rescinded, we have been working with agencies to monitor any disruptions to federal funding. You know, in those early days, there was a lot of activity, and since then, we've stood up a process for agencies to report to us when funds are disrupted. When we hear about a disruption, we talk about what does that mean, what is the impact, where are these dollars going, and also what are your alternative funding sources? Is there something else you could leverage to make sure that these services continue if you determine that's the right course of action? We also collect and analyze incoming federal guidance and new executive orders to understand what does that mean for the state budget. In many cases, some of the communications are vague and the impact of the state budget isn't known, especially I'd note some of the early executive orders sort of laid out a policy vision and directed federal agencies to work on a plan, and we have not necessarily seen the outcome of that work yet, but I think that's something that we'll start to see more of in the coming months. So I just mentioned that we've set up a process for monitoring disruptions. And this slide just provides you a little update on what we're seeing right now. We've had dozens of state awards disrupted. And when I say disrupted, that means a lot of things, and in some cases it's more of an art than a science. In some cases, agencies are explicitly not able to access federal funding portals, or you log into the website and an award is like grayed out, you know, when you can't click on something, like something we probably all experience. There are also places where an agency submits a reimbursement, and when we might be accustomed to receiving something in 24 or 48 hours, the reimbursement just doesn't come. And in yet other cases, our state agencies have been notified by federal partners that funds are under review and that they shouldn't bill anything, or maybe in some cases only submit billing for work that occurred up until January 20th and don't bill us for anything else yet. And so we are, talking with agencies to say, like, is this a disruption or is just this like a normal course of business? I'd know that as of the afternoon of March 20th, so this was late last week, we had 24 state awards that were unable to access federal funding. So one at the Department of Commerce, one at the Department of Health, two at Agriculture, and then 20 at the Department of Public Safety. These are sort of a suite of FEMA funding. But the availability is very fluid, and status has changed from day to day. So pivoting now to potential changes in federal funding. As you just heard, the U.S. House passed a budget resolution that calls for significant reductions in spending. I think the framework lays out $2 trillion in cuts, but the specific targets, I think, add up to about $1.5 trillion. Of that, $880 billion is in the commerce and energy space, which includes Medicaid, and $230 billion is in the Agriculture Committee, which includes SNAP. There are other places that have potential interactions with the state budget, but I just call these out because of, as you saw in the previous slide, these are some really big programs running through our state agencies. These are really their budget targets, something that you all are used to dealing with, so they don't speak to what policies underlie them to achieve these savings. And depending on what is chosen, it could have significant ramifications for our budget. In addition to the impacts of congressional action, there are potential impacts from federal administrative action. And I think in the Medicaid and human services space in particular, things like what waivers is the federal government going to approve? What rules are they setting that drive reimbursement methodologies? And those are things that are just going to be revealed over time. So with that, I'll pivot and turn it over to my colleague here to talk about changes to Medicaid in particular.
Mr. Green.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Greenman. I'm the Chief Financial Officer with the Department of Human Services. I'm going to talk a little bit about potential impacts of federal actions on the Medicaid program and what we're doing to plan for those. Just as a little bit of background, just as a reminder to folks, as Ms. Mingy mentioned, Medicaid has a significant impact and footprint throughout the state. Medicaid covers between 20 and 25% of all residents in the state, about 1.2 million Minnesotans, and that includes about 42% of all children in the state. It also pays for about one half of all long-term care services for persons with disabilities and senior citizens. In addition to the people served, Medicaid spends around $20 billion per year in payments to providers throughout the state, nursing homes, hospitals, physicians, other services covered by Medicaid, as well as making payments to counties and tribal governments for the cost of administering human services in the state. Approximately 57% of Medicaid spending is funded by the federal government. And just as a way of thinking about it, for every dollar the state spends, the federal government spends about $1.33. As Ms. Mingy mentioned, that percentage is about 51% for most groups, it's about 90% for one group. So it averages out to about 57%. It's important, too, I think, to note that when you look at the entire state budget, federal funds and state funds, Medicaid accounts for about 17% of all spending in the state. So it's a pretty significant source of funding in the state. As Ms. Mingy mentioned, the House budget resolution that passed a few weeks ago includes about $880 billion in reductions over 10 years for the committee that oversees Medicaid and Medicare spending. If Medicare is excluded from that, from those cuts, Medicaid accounts for about 93% of what's left of that committee's budget. So reductions would have to come heavily from federal reductions in Medicaid spending. Recent analysis by the Congressional Budget Office indicates that federal Medicaid reductions would have to be somewhere between about $745 billion and $880 billion over the next 10 years. And this would amount to a reduction in the federal outlay for Medicaid of about 10 to 12%. Now, we don't know exactly, as Ms. Miggy mentioned, there has been no proposal, concrete proposal, for how Medicaid would be reduced. We've not seen any of those proposals yet, so we don't know exactly what actions would be taken. But if one were to distribute a reduction of the size of, that we're talking about proportionally across all states, Minnesota would see a reduction of between $1.4 and $1.6 billion in federal spending in fiscal year 27. And that would increase over time. One thing, as I mentioned earlier, this is obviously a complicated and fluid situation in Congress right now. And the person from the NCSL had the same comment. We don't have any specific proposals in front of us. We do know that the Senate has a budget resolution that's significantly smaller than the House in terms of cuts because they're doing a two-step process. And the first step that they're currently undertaking does not pay for the extension of federal tax cuts, so it has a much smaller reduction. And I think there's potentially a ways to go in terms of negotiating what's going to potentially happen. We've heard over time a number of potential ways in which Medicaid could be reduced at the federal level, and have been DHS and our MMB partners have been thinking about how that might impact the Medicaid program in Minnesota. One of those, it would be per capita caps or spending or block granting federal spending. There are several ways in which the federal government could potentially do this or could structure this. It could set limits on growth in per capita spending on the federal side, or it could cap growth in overall federal spending. And based on a measure of inflation, medical spending, or some other factor. Depending on how it's structured, it could have a significant impact on Minnesota because we currently do pay, we're at the very top in terms of per capita spending on Medicaid enrollees and compared to other states. Another option would be, Ms. Miggy mentioned earlier that the ACA expansion group, Adults Without Children, we currently get a federal match of 90%. Another proposed federal action that's been discussed is reducing that FMAP, they call it the FMAP rate, from 90% down to the rate that is applies to other population groups, which would be about a 51% reduction from 90% to 51%, which would be a significant impact. Work requirements have also been discussed, requiring Medicaid enrollees that meet certain criteria to either perform work or community service. This is something that we have seen previously, or that's been proposed previously, actually several years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. We did look at something similar. We fiscal note of the legislation. And a couple of things around that: work requirements would require a lot of administrative work because somebody, the counties, would need to be determining whether people are qualified for an exemption or would have to work. They would have to monitor people, make sure that they're working or not working, and would need to take eligibility action if they're not. So this would be a fairly significant, from our previous experience with this type of proposal, had a significant impact on counties. And I think also there are several significant numbers of people who could be enrolled in one of two different eligibility groups within Medicaid, and so there would be potentially some people switching from one eligibility type to another as a result of the work requirements. We don't yet know, we don't have a good sense of what the fiscal impact of that would be. Like with all of these proposals, it would really depend on how it's structured. The federal government's already also looking at limiting what we call healthcare provider taxes. Minnesota, like virtually every other state, uses a series of taxes, fees, and surcharges to finance part of the state share of Medicaid and other healthcare programs in the state. These instances, rate adjustments are typically used to offset the cost to the taxpayers, those providers paying the taxes. So often those offsetting or hold harmless provisions keep them from having to pay the entire amount or offset some of the cost to them. There are federal rules on limiting how these healthcare provider taxes can be applied. And there's a potential that the federal government will change those rules, which would affect the extent to which Minnesota can use these and other states can use these kinds of revenue sources to help fund the state share of the Medicaid program and Minnesota Care program. Finally, the last item I'll just talk about briefly is eliminating the floor on the FMAP, which is the federal share. As Ms. Mingy mentioned, the bottom line, the minimum is 50%. Minnesota's a little bit above that. If the floor were removed, states that are at 50% would potentially go below that in terms of a federal match. That wouldn't immediately affect Minnesota because we're not at the 50% minimum. In terms of impacts to Minnesota, we are looking carefully to try to understand how these might impact us and be thinking about planning purposes. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen, but we think it's prudent, obviously, to be planning for and looking at and understanding what we might have to do in the future in terms of budgets. Just a couple of some of these potential federal actions are easier to estimate than others. Losing the enhanced FMAP for the ACA expansion group could result in a loss of about $1.2 to $1.3 billion annually to the state in federal funding, and then stricter limits on healthcare provider taxes could also jeopardize our ability to use those revenue sources to fund our MA Minnesota Care programs, and those bring in a combined, those revenues that are related to Medicaid and Minnesota Care bring in about $1.2 billion a year annually. And with that, I will turn it back over to Ms. Mingy.
So I think some themes from our conversation today is that the sort of unclear lack of federal guidance and inconsistent access to federal funds, as well as uncertainty about the future federal budget, creates challenges for both state agencies and for policymakers such as yourselves. I'm sure the slide says the upcoming budget forecast, but I should have said our recent budget forecast does not incorporate changes to federal spending. So we assumed in the February forecast that there are no federal law changes related to Medicaid. Because we do a current law forecast on the spending side, and as we know, we can't predict what will happen at the federal level. But it's, I mean, obviously loss of billions of dollars in federal Medicaid funding would significantly worsen the state's financial position. And you all would need to consider budgetary solutions to a larger budget shortfall. So if it was $2 or $2.5 billion worse per biennium, that could mean reductions coming out of the Medicaid space. It could be other entitlements or other state spending generally, or changes in the state revenue. So with that, I think we are happy to take any questions.
Thank you. I'm going to start with a question for me. Ms. Mingy, you know, I think one of the things that we've talked a lot about today is how this is a quickly changing scenario. And I think I've seen some of these charts before, including one that talked about the disrupted federal funding. And I think the last time I saw this chart, there were substantially fewer awards that had been disrupted by federal action. And I was struck by the fact that you have 20 different awards at the Department of Public Safety that have been disrupted. And I wonder if you can speak at all to what types of programming is impacted there.
Mr. Chair, I think one thing I'd note is these are part of the reason for the large number at DPS is these are all sort of unique grant funding streams. So it might be like 3 years of grants for the same program. I think there are programs like some cybersecurity funding, some pre-disaster funding. There's a number of grants that we can provide a list to the committee. I'd note you mentioned the sort of rapidly fluctuating numbers. There are, since we started counting, which was not on January 28th, or it was probably a few days after, so we definitely missed a large number, but since we started tracking, we've tracked over or about 50 awards that have been disrupted, and so this is more than half have come on the off the list, while others have then come back on the list, and some blink on and off over the course of weeks.
Thank you. Cybersecurity, disaster funding, these sound like important things. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Mingy, going to the transportation slide, Do you think that some of these cuts, are they going to be more formal funding or discretionary funding? Can you predict at all?
Ms. Bengi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, could you repeat the question?
I'm sorry. For the transportation side, do you think that these cuts proposed are going to be more formulary or discretionary?
Ms. Mingy.
Or do you have no clue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, I would struggle to predict that.
And then
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have any of the grant announcements from January been contracted yet for the Department of Transportation, like the RAISE grants and things like those?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, I think I know there are still a long list of things from January that we are waiting to have signed. I would need to defer to the Department of Transportation, and since there was such a significant list, I don't want to say that nothing has moved, but my understanding is there are a lot of things that are still on hold.
Any additional follow-up, Representative Cagle? Representative Katizabutun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here with us today and kind of walking us through the short and long-term impacts of these proposals at the federal level and the devastating impact that they would have on the Minnesotans everywhere, but particularly the children and families of the state of Minnesota. Some of these proposals regarding SNAP and our Child Care Development Block Grant, TANF, I mean, these things are very worthy investments in people at some of the most vulnerable times in their life. And you know, there's many studies that kind of tell us if we are to invest in advance, Representative Coulter, who's on the Children and Families Committee, likes to say, pay me now or pay me later, right? So when we're not investing in early childhood special education, that's going to lead to a greater cost in K through 12 special education, and potentially larger costs to the community beyond grade 12. I think this also is really clear when we talk about the potential cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, because when people don't have insurance coverage that they need, they end up in the emergency room. So I'm just curious if that's something you guys have a really difficult job trying to preview and predict what might happen if we pull one lever versus the other lever. But if people don't have insurance coverage and they end up in the emergency room, we talk about the cost of care. Have we explored that at all and what that looks like down the line?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we haven't done analysis about the cost of uncompensated care or the impacts of potential changes in coverage, but certainly those are conversations that are the economic, the value of Medicaid funding and the magnitude of it as a payer in our state healthcare system is certainly something that's part of the conversation. But Mr. Greenman, if you have anything.
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, not really anything more to add other than that we are aware that you know, when you aren't, that the healthcare, the needs for services aren't going to go away. If Medicaid spending goes down, they're going to continue to be there. It's a matter of who's paying, and it's often hard to track where those costs are going to show up, both in terms of predicting where they're going to show up and actually understanding where that is all going to hit the economy, the system.
Representative Casizabusun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that we just need to reiterate the importance, whether it is healthcare, whether it is education, whether it is the public infrastructure and our roads and bridges, the cost is going to come to us, whether it's now and we can prevent some of these issues down the line, or it's going to exacerbate the problem and come to us in a giant payment future years from now. So I really think that I appreciate you bringing this presentation to the committee today. I think this is really important as we look at what comes next for our constituents and our state. But it's scary. These numbers, these cuts, choosing the wealthy few over the American people, the Minnesotan people, is going to have long reaching impacts, not just this year, not just next year, but decades down the line.
Thank you, Representative Katizabutun. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Mingy and Mr. Greenman, for being here today. I wanted to just ask a question on page 11 regarding the disruptions that you talked about to state awards already. And I know that those, some of those are access to funding portals that have been closed and then opened, and then other ones, reimbursements simply not paid yet, under review. All of these things that you're charting and tracking, are those things that you could give us some more information on in the weeks and months to come? Because all of these are going to really have an impact on our immediate budget.
Ms. Mingy.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, we're happy to provide the committee the list of both currently disrupted awards as well as awards that have sort of been disrupted, and also give you a sense of the sort of the nature of like why they are on the list.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Mingy, for that. That would be really helpful if we could get an assessment of what, as it goes forward, as you track it, get an update. A second question, please, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Greenman, on page 15, you talked about some of the stricter limits that may be imposed on the use of healthcare provider taxes and directed payments. And you did go into a little bit on the healthcare provider taxes, but I'm wondering, is that a decision that HHS can make, or is that also, I would expect, would need congressional review?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, I believe that that is an adjustment that can be made administratively, but I will follow up with you on that. I'm not 100% sure.
That would be helpful.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be very helpful if you could follow up on that. Also, you know, you spoke a little on the healthcare provider taxes, but I'm also wondering about the directed payments, because these are utilized across the country in so many ways to improve health for people in the country, and just any more information you have on potential changes in those programs would be important to know. Thank you.
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, we'd be happy to get more information about directed payments as well.
Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
That's it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for having folks in today. And I don't quite even know where to start with education, because it's not just the U.S. Department of Education that we get money from for our kids in school. That covers some special education, what they've given us, not the whole 40% they promised. It includes Tier 1 and Tier 4 supports for our most needy students. It includes the Pell Grants. I know that is in itself about 10% of our schools, of our state budget. I don't know if any of those have been paused yet. Do you have any more information about, I know within the Department of Education, there's a group of folks that crunch the numbers to do the formula, because formulas are a little more fair than block grants. I had heard through the news, which that's where we seem to be getting our information nowadays, that most of that department has been let go. So have you seen disruption in being able to pull down funds right now in any of the areas that we get from the U.S. Department of Education?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I mentioned, we don't have any current disruptions from the U.S. Department of Education on our list. I'm aware that in recent weeks, the portal to draw down funds from the Department of Education was briefly down, I think for probably less than a day. But the ongoing challenge of the impact of reductions in the federal workforce and the timeliness of federal payments is something I'm not sure if we have experienced yet, but I do think it's reasonable to think that some of our historic like timeframes for reimbursement will change if some federal sort of workforce changes are sort of persist.
Representative Joachim.
Yes, I also am worried about the funding that we get from agriculture for our universal meals. So even if we weren't doing universal meals, we'd be getting close to 60% of our school district's funding for food from the federal government. And then the schools, we gave a little bit at the state level, and then the schools picked up the rest. Now, of course, with universal meals, we picked up the state level funding. Is that being talked about at the agricultural department as well as SNAP and other items?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the large proposals that I am seeing discussed for the savings at federal ag target are mostly SNAP oriented because it is such a significant program, but I think I don't know that that means other things are off the table. It's just some things generate more savings. For example, one proposal that is being discussed for SNAP is the creation of a state share. Like right now, SNAP is 100% federally funded, the benefits, and the administrative costs are split between the, are sort of shared with the federal government. But if, for example, the federal government created a state share for SNAP, that could cost us something, you know, in the tens to hundreds of millions of dollars. But so I think the just in terms of federal budget tracking and reporting, the people are focusing on SNAP just because of the magnitude of some of the changes.
Representative Yukim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Assistant Commissioner. One of the other things I'm worried about in looking at the House resolution with the Medicaid cuts is we do a lot of services for our students in our schools through physical therapy, occupational therapy, social work, special education, where we bill back MA to recoup some of those funds. Do you see any disruption there yet, or what is that looking like in the forecast moving forward?
I don't know if that's Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have not seen any specific proposal that would target those particular benefits provided in schools, but you're correct. We do bill Medicaid for a lot of those services, and we've taken advantage of that quite a bit in Minnesota to, and often the school districts will pick up the non-federal share and then and recoup some of their costs through the federal match. I think it would be probably, you know, there'd be a broader conversation if we were to see some Medicaid cuts about how those would be absorbed within the overall state government budget. So I think that would be part of the conversation.
Representative Yukim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just kind of one final comment, too. I just talking to a bunch of school groups, well, one already this morning and two later today, and our students are very smart, and they're worried, and they're asking what their school year is going to look like next year, not just for themselves but for their friends. And I think this uncertainty is affecting everyone, and sometimes we forget it's affecting our folks that are supposed to be concentrating on learning right now. So want to say thank you, and we guess we're all in this together, and we'll have to figure it out, but it's something that we shouldn't have to figure out because it's, as Chair Katisa Batun said, the cost that we'll see down the pike will be even bigger than the cost or the savings we're seeing right now. Thank you.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Mingyi, thanks for the presentation. I'm wondering what would the impact be or the implication be if additional federal grants or awards were eliminated for projects like the Northern Lights Express commuter rail? If that project was eliminated and we stopped working on it, I believe that would bring $200 million back into the state budget that we could use on other transportation projects or fill other budget reductions and reforms. Is that right?
Ms. Mingyi.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I think there was a one-time appropriation that is, I think, about a couple hundred million dollars, but I would need to look for the exact number.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask about the enhanced FMAP for the AC expansion. Do we know how many individuals will be impacted for that area?
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative Neuer, in terms of enrollees under that category of eligibility, we can find that for you very quickly. If that federal revenue source went down, that would be a hole in the budget that would need to be solved for. So MMB, the governor's office, the legislature would be looking at what are the options for addressing that. But the state would automatically then pick up that difference between what the 90% the feds cover and the current FMAP rate. So I will be trying to talk long enough to find the number, but I can get you the enrollee
It's about 220,000.
Yeah.
So
right here,
in total, who will be losing that? You know, will be impacted even if we reduce it. And then for the FMAP, you know, the reduction. Right now, we are on the lowest number possible at 51%, going to 50, you know, around that area. So how low can we go when it comes to the FMAP percentage that we are contributing?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuer, as Ms. Mingy mentioned earlier, the FMAP rate that every state has is based on average income and relative to the rest of the country. And Minnesota is right, has historically been right near the bottom every year. Right now we're like 51.16%, I think. The minimum is 50 right now. If the floor, and even that's, I would say even that small percentage is, I mean, when you're talking about a program is with an $18 billion annual budget, like MET, or $20 billion, that's a lot of money. So going down to 50% would be, you know, would be in the tens of millions of dollars. If the federal, there was a federal, potentially a federal proposal that would eliminate that floor, because right now the floor, you can't go below 50, and I think there's a handful of states that are right there. So they would potentially go below that level. I don't know exactly where they would end up, but Minnesota right now, because we're not at the floor, would be, I wouldn't say safe, but ours wouldn't necessarily change if that proposal were to go into place, because we're not at the floor at this point.
Representative Noor.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just had a comment regarding Chair Youakim's comments on education, and I find it just, you know, a little bit frustrating. After we put the DFL-led legislature and governor put over 60 mandates on our schools that were already driving them into deficits, I just saw Anoka-Hennepin School District outside of this room before I came in. And I hope you're contacting Governor Walz, because what he's doing is causing overall a budget budget deficit or a $20 million cut to Anoka-Hennepin schools. So I hope that you sincerely look at what you can do to remedy that and talk with our governor about maybe not being so cruel to this school district and the kids of Anoka-Hennepin, the largest school district in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since my name was mentioned, yes, I have talked to them. I know very well what's in the governor's budget. It's a lot of stuff that's in there that is an absolutely no-go on both sides of the aisle. I'm still trying to figure out exactly where they're trying to go and what they want. So, yes, Chair Cruz and I are both looking at that very closely.
I think Representative Cagle, you had a quick follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention that, you know, a lot of the funding that we spent last year was one time. And I think if we'd collected probably all of that one-time funding, we wouldn't be able to fill this massive budget hole that we're looking at. And so one question I just had, are these proposed cuts ongoing?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, these targets that are laid out in the House Budget Resolution are 10-year cut targets.
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the conversation today, because we all are watching what's happening around us. All the other states are doing the same thing we're doing. But let's be honest here, members. We knew this day was coming, to have these conversations about the federal deficit. I mean, we are talking about this, which is really important. I think we've got really smart state folks looking at the numbers about the what ifs and how do we arrange for this and how do we pivot. Again, there's a lot of things that have been said. We've seen it here over the last several years about the spending that we've had and the things that we maybe shouldn't have done and all those hypotheticals. But these are a lot of the what ifs right now, and I don't want citizens in Minnesota to think the sky is falling here, because it's not. The elections were clear in November, and we have to make sure that citizens of this country said we can't sustain the kind of spending and have a carry-on. And yes, Minnesota might have some part of this to pick up our tools and figure out a way to take care of our citizens like we all know we can do. But we can't do it pretending that the federal government just is at a complete spend thrifty as much as they want without having problems with that. This is a serious issue that we need to address. But I just want to make sure that we are in a state that will not give up and throw our hands up and think we can't fix these things that come along. So maybe my question to Ms. Mingy or Mr. Greenman, are we talking to all of our congressional delegation on both sides of the aisle about what are they doing? Are they listening to our concerns? What are they sharing with us? And are they also at the table so they know what our areas of real concern are? I mean, are those conversations happening now, or is it just with the folks in the agencies, or is it really happening in a bipartisan fashion to say, where are the areas that we're most concerned about? So this is a discussion we must have in this finance committee, but we need to make sure that we're doing it and listening to our folks that are elected to that represent us. And I want to just say, are we having those kind of conversations right now?
Representative Baker, I'll put that question to Ms. Mingy, Mr. Greenman. But first, I did just want to take issue a little bit with your comment that this is about federal spending and too much federal spending, because as we saw from the NCSL presentation, the budget that was passed by the House includes $4.5 trillion in tax cuts, but $2 trillion in spending reductions, only, as Ms. Mingy said, 1.5 of which were actually identified. So this budget increases the federal deficit and increases the federal debt by $2 trillion plus. The national debt, you know, right now is $36 trillion. So that's a 5% increase just by this one document. So characterizing this as being about runaway federal spending when this proposal actually increases the federal deficit is, I think, incorrect. And if you want to respond to that, I'll give you the opportunity, but I'm happy to give your question to Ms. Mingy if you want. Okay, Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I know that concerns have been flagged for members of the congressional delegation.
Representative Baker.
No, thank you very much for that. Again, there's new leadership. There's new changes happening at the federal level. We have to deal with that. I'm willing to say that we'll deal with this when we need to. If we get called back here because we did pass a budget that we are required to do, and if we have new information down the road, we'll deal with this. But I just want to make sure that we are resilient. Our state will do well. We'll figure out how to do this. But there is also, as mentioned earlier, there's a lot of unfunded mandates coming yet out next year to businesses and to schools and counties. We have to deal with those right now. And we are certainly going to be having some hard conversations coming forward because, again, I think America needs to look at the checkbook pretty hard. So appreciate the comments.
And Representative Baker, I share your long-term optimism about the state of Minnesota. I also want to thank you. You and I think Representative Schumacher signed a letter to President Trump about the proposed Medicaid cuts, and I appreciate you sending that letter. Representative Pinto.
And Chair, you made the point that I was going to make about how this, in fact, would increase the debt and the deficit. Thank you.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to see a new chair here. You know, I'm kind of tired of the old ones. So, and thank you both for being with us today. First, for Ms. Mingy, a few questions I have. Looking at page 3 of your presentation, where you outline total federal funds involved here in the state of Minnesota, I noticed that you went to the all funds budget. What percentage of the general fund budget is federal money?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Co-Chair Torkelson, so the federal funds don't flow through the state general fund, which is why we took the all funds lens. But if we were to say that federal funds make up, you know, about $40 to $45 billion, and the general fund budget in the next biennium is more like $66 billion, that's probably about two-thirds. Like, the federal money is equivalent to about two-thirds of the state general fund, based on my sort of quick mental math.
Representative Torkelson.
That sounds pretty steep, Mr. Chair. I don't think federal funds are two-thirds of our general fund budget, but I'll wait for a more accurate answer.
I think Ms. Mingy was saying that they're equivalent to about two-thirds of the general fund. The total amount of federal funds equates to about two-thirds of what the general fund is, not that the general fund is made up two-thirds of federal
funds. Well, my question, though, Mr. Chair, was what amount of federal funds are actually part of the general fund, because after all, it's our job as a committee to present a balanced general fund budget, and so just trying to get to the bottom of that. I'll move on, Mr. Chair. On page 12, and you talk about the cuts, potential cuts, and you talk about, you know, huge numbers, but what percentage of the money coming to Minnesota is anticipated in these cuts?
Ms. Mingy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, as we mentioned, it's hard to say specifically because the actual policy mechanisms underlying these reductions is unknown. As Mr. Greenman mentioned, if we think that this is potentially 10 to 12 constitute a 10 to 12% reduction in federal outlays for Medicaid, which then translates to about $1.4 to $1.6 billion a year of the funding coming to the state budget. So that's one of the things that's sort of a rough approximation, but it's really too early to say without seeing the language.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Mr. Mingy. Yes, of course, it's hard to say of all of these numbers because none of them have been written in stone. The cement is still very wet. But that I was going to go back to that 10 to 12% that you do mention on page 14 of your document regarding Medicaid funding, as you just already reiterated. So that kind of puts this in a little perspective. I'll get back to that in a moment. But I have a question for Mr. Greenman. On page 15, you talk about the fact that Minnesota is an overachiever in some federal programs as far as how much we fund. How far over the top, over average, do we go?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I'd have to get that information for you. I think we are, in terms of overall per capita spending on Medicaid, in terms of the amount spent per enrollee, I believe we're third in the country. And that's based on some data from, I think it was some national data from, I think it was from the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Representative Torkelson.
Oh, thank you for that, Mr. Greenman. In other words, we are very near the top. And how much we spend as a state compared to the other 47 states across the country. That's enough questions for the testifiers. Mr. Chair, if we have a 10% cut in federal money coming to Minnesota out of the 42.35 billion, that's what I calculate based on the figures on page 3, that would be about $4.2 billion that we are potentially losing from the state or from the federal government coming to the state of Minnesota. I can't help but think back to just two short years ago when we had $18 billion in a surplus. If we had just held back one-third of that, we'd have way more than enough money right now to address these potential federal cuts, which haven't happened yet, by the way, because this is just a House proposal. We know the House is probably a little more leaning a little harder to the right than the Senate will. They have different rules in the Senate for passing things. So what actually comes out of these deliberations, we don't know. But last biennium, the Democrats grew state government by what I would call three bienniums worth of growth. I mean, the state budget grows. If you look back historically, we've been growing at about a 10 to 12% rate over time. We jumped 36 to 40% last year. We grew three bienniums worth of growth in one biennium. If we had just cut it back to two bienniums worth, we'd still have plenty of money to address these federal challenges. I was not a Boy Scout, Mr. Chair. I was in 4-H, so I didn't have the Be Prepared model. But if we want to be smart about this situation, we need to be conservative with our budget. That means that we need to cut spending now. We need to put more money on the bottom line so that come whenever these federal carts come, we are prepared here in Minnesota to meet the demand. Be prepared, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you, Representative Torkelson. You know, I would just observe, you commented that we would have had enough money to weather the storm if we had held back more of the surplus, but I think this is a difference between one-time versus ongoing situation. The comment was your math, $4.2 billion, that would be each biennium. This is a 10-year budget. So we're talking about actually $40 billion worth of impact to the state, probably more than that because it will grow year after year. It's just 4.2 in the first year, and it will grow beyond that. There's no way that any amount of saving in the last biennium would have been able allowed us to withstand the amount of cuts that could be coming from the federal government, which, you know, would be calamitous to the state's budget. And I hope members, I asked the question about timing. It's clear that we probably won't be able to account for this in our regular session, so I wouldn't plan any can't-miss vacations in September or October, because if this happens, we will have to come back here and deal with these cuts and find a way not only to balance our budget but to protect the Minnesotans that rely on these programs. The most alarming statistic I heard today wasn't the billions of dollars that this will blow a hole in our state budget. It was the fact that 42% of children rely on Medicaid in Minnesota. And if we have massive cuts to Medicaid, how many kids are going to go without health care? That was the most alarming thing to me. We have a big challenge in front of us. Obviously, we need to produce a balanced budget. We are a tied legislature. We're going to have to work together. But I fear that that challenge is only going to get bigger in the weeks and months to come. Thank you, members, for the great discussion today. And with that, the committee is adjourned.